This is Jim Engster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We will visit with Bishop Cynthia Fierro Harvey of the Louisiana Conference of the United Methodist Church on her work with 486 congregations in the state and over 118,000 members. And today, of course, is the day that Billy Graham has his funeral. He died earlier this week at the age of 99. Writer Jennifer Moses, on her feature about Plaquemines Parish, which appeared in last Sunday's New York Times. The Times did a major piece on coastal issues affecting Louisiana. And film critic John Wirt on the 90th Annual Academy Awards event. Will there be any surprises this weekend? We'll talk with John Wirt about the best films, actors and actresses, and much more. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana on WRKF. Your numbers are anywhere you may be, 877-217-5757, and locally, 297-5633. You can always send us an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. We start our show today with Bishop Cynthia Fierro Harvey. She represents 486 congregations and 118,000 members in the state of Louisiana as Bishop of the Louisiana Annual Conference of the United Methodist Church. She's one of 65 bishops across the country. A national council was just held in Dallas, and she is fresh from being in her home state of Texas and talking with us. She's been in Baton Rouge now for 6 years, and before we get to her work, today is the day that Billy Graham will be put to rest. He died at the age of 99, lived from 1918 to 2018. He was not a Methodist, but certainly the most famous Protestant preacher in the history of the world.
Absolutely.
What do you think his legacy is?
Oh, my gosh. There is so much to say about Reverend Graham. And one of the things that I love that Franklin Graham has said about his father is that his father hasn't died, that his father is very much alive. And and when the council met last week, one of the things that we chose to do was to send a letter of condolence to the Graham family. And I said, you know, I don't know that I can send a letter of condolence, but I can send a letter celebrating his life, because he was that, you know, pastor's pastor, pastor to the world, frankly. And he stood for segregation and civil rights at a time that was pretty risky business to
stood
do.
Stood against segregation.
Against it, yes. Yeah. Yes, stood against all of that. And I think that particularly for us here in the South, that was an incredible witness to the world and continues to be. I think his legacy is going to live on because of, you know, filling stadiums. Yeah. I remember as a child watching it on my little black and white television and filling stadiums all over the world. So this isn't – he's been a pastor, a mentor to presidents and so many people. So his influence is obviously deep.
You're a daughter of the Lone Star State, graduated from the University of Texas at Austin, and spent 12 years in the corporate world.
I did. I spent 12 years working for the Rouse Company, which is a developer that developed places like the Inner Harbor in Baltimore. I spent a lot of time in New Orleans because we took over the World's Fair pavilions down there on the Riverwalk. Right. And so I've been around a lot. It was great training. It's probably my best education for actually leading the church today. Enjoyed that work and was really blessed to be able to have that opportunity.
And you've been involved in many endeavors in your career, and your corporate experience has helped you with one of the big events in Louisiana, a cataclysmic event, the flooding of 2016. Mm. How have you been involved with that?
Well, it's interesting that my election happened. I'll just go back because this will give you a little idea of the impact of 2016. I was elected in 2012, and if you remember, that was Hurricane Isaac. Mm-hmm. And I was elected while serving as the Deputy General Secretary of the United Methodist Committee on Relief, which deals with disasters all over the world. And I followed the Red Cross disaster response truck across the Mississippi River Bridge. And I said to my husband, I said, I guess it's okay to start from your strength. So I arrived here in the midst of a hurricane recovery. And then 2016 came, and that was just devastating for us. And the fact that it wasn't a named hurricane also provided some challenges. It was an election year, and we got pretty much buried underneath a lot of news. But fortunately, we've been able to raise almost $4 million for recovery across the state of Louisiana. And just also to remember that just a few months before, in March of that year, we'd had flooding up in the northern part of the state. So now we had the whole state impacted by flooding. We're still in the recovery efforts. We've spent about half of that money. We said in 2016 that it would be about a five-year recovery process. I think we're probably going to be in a five-year recovery process. So the work,
at least,
the work is still going strong. We have teams. This is spring break for a lot of college campuses and families, and churches plan a lot of mission trips during this time. So we have a lot of folk coming in. We have about a couple hundred in the month of March, and we hope to build to that coming in the summer because there's still people living in trailers. We've been instrumental in working with a lot of other agencies to help people stay in a mobile home. We want to avoid using those trailers just because of our experience with Katrina.
We're visiting with Cynthia Fierro Harvey. She is the bishop of the Louisiana Annual Conference of the United Methodist Church. Your number again is 877-217-5757. She's held this position for the last 6 years as Bishop Harvey. And you mentioned the storm. Certainly, we wish the people on the East Coast well.
They're battling
their own issues today. But the Methodist Church is considered by some to be a bit less dogmatic than other Protestant churches. Is that fair, or is that a misconception?
That's fairly fair. Can we say that? We're not a creedal church. We believe we pitch a pretty big tent. And that's my hope for our future, frankly, that our tent can actually grow wider. We've just been dealing, like a lot of other denominations, on the issue of human sexuality. And it is a dividing issue, just as it is across the country. We're a reflection. The United Methodist Church is a reflection of that. And bishops are working right now with a commission, a 32-member named commission, to find a way forward. Actually, it's called the Commission on a Way Forward. 2016, at our general conference, the bishops were asked to lead. And this is part of our hope in leading the church to a place where everyone can find a place at the table, that the table is wide enough, that the tent is big enough, to allow our differences, not uniformity. There's a difference between unity and uniformity. We really want unity. We don't all have to be the same. That would actually be fairly dull.
Well, are gay people allowed to be members of good standing in the Methodist Church?
Yes, sir. They are.
And we have this perception by some fundamentalists that the sexuality, if it's not heterosexual, is inappropriate and perhaps is worthy of condemnation. You don't sound like you're on that
well,
level.
Our Book of Discipline, actually, in 1972, there was a statement added that says that homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching. And that's been a challenge since 1972. It's challenged every year by many.
Your church.
In our United Methodist Church. And currently, it really becomes an issue of how you interpret Scripture and contextuality. Where are you? Because we are a global church. We have churches, United Methodists. We have 5 million of them outside the United States. And how they contextualize and interpret homosexuality. In some countries, I understand from one of our bishops recently that there doesn't even exist a word for homosexuality. So it is a challenge of how do we live in unity without all having to be the same, understand the same. And I think actually that's what frankly makes us United Methodists. It's part of our heritage, the yes and.
But religion continues to divide people. It's, I think, designed to unite, but more than not, often we argue over our beliefs.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. And, you know, today, talking about Billy Graham, he was a uniting force for so many things. And if we really believe that our work in the church is to bring people to Jesus, I think that is our main focus. In Louisiana, we continue to say that we hold nothing sacred but the mission, and that is to make disciples of Jesus Christ for the transformation of the world.
Mm-hmm. Where do you think the Methodist Church is heading in our country?
I wish I could. I wish I had a crystal ball and able to answer that question. I would hope that we would lead towards some unity, and I think a way for people to not feel excluded, whether you are on the right, on the left, or in the center. Is there a place for all of those viewpoints and all of those folk to be at the table?
Mm-hmm. Did you have a calling?
Oh, yes, I did. I grew up Roman Catholic. So my experience as a woman was one that I'd never saw women preachers. I saw nuns, and mm-hmm. I knew I didn't want to do that. So I struggled with that call throughout my life. And it wasn't until I was well into my corporate life and I got involved in a local church, and really that calling that was there even as a child, I think, was solidified in really being able to experience the love and grace of God in really extraordinary ways.
As a country right now, we're divided in any number of ways. How do you feel about that?
you don't want me to go there, do you? Really?
Sure.
We are. And I think we live in a season right now where it seems like we have freedom to say things and do things that I'm not sure would be acceptable.
Well, we thank you for joining us. Hopefully the first of many appearances.
Thank you.
Bishop Cynthia Fierro-Harvey, an enthusiastic person with an infectious personality. It's been an honor.
Thank you.
This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. And Jennifer Moses is with us. She is an accomplished writer. She's been with us several times before, but it's been a few years. And she spent a lot of years in Baton Rouge and here in New Jersey today. I understand it's quite treacherous there right now. How are you doing, Jennifer?
Well, it's not so treacherous. It's just a little snowy and blowy.
Well, you could have some bad stuff happening, and you know the lay of the land, having been in Louisiana.
Right. Not too many hurricanes.
Well,
or just a lot of white fluffy stuff.
But before stuff. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's all. You know, the big danger for me is the dogs bring it in, and then I've got snow and wet puddles and hair all over my house.
Well, you have written prolifically about Louisiana, and most recently in Sunday's New York Times, and you went to a place that is a little off the beaten path, and you came through with another fascinating feature, as you often do. Tell us about what sent you to Plaquemines Parish.
What sent me to Plaquemines Parish, honestly, is I'd never been there before. And I lived in Baton Rouge for 13 years. And saw a lot of the state and went to all kinds of funky little corners of Louisiana that even lifelong Louisianans never go to. I think partly because I wasn't native. I had a kind of pulsating curiosity about this strange place that, you know, that became my home. But I'd never been to Plaquemines, and my youngest son now lives in New. You know, he went right back after college. He went to college in Boston. Went right back to Louisiana. He now lives in New Orleans, and he'd been going down there and telling me about it. So you know, there I was. So I was able to kind of double dip and go see Jonathan in New Orleans and borrow his car and tootle on down to Plaquemines.
Well, your story in Sunday's New York Times says, "If New Orleans is an aging beauty queen drunk on the fumes of her glorious past, Plaquemines Parish to the southeast is plain old sloshed, not to mention saturated, slivered and surrounded by water. And no wonder the peninsula that comprises most of the parish was born many years ago when the Mississippi River shifted, creating a sliver of land melding into its extensive wetlands. It's a beautiful area that often people never see, people who even live in Louisiana. But you went there, and certainly you found a lot of worthwhile places and people to cover.
Well, yeah, but it's, you know, look, Plaquemines is beautiful the way a lot of South Louisiana is beautiful. It's very fragile. It's also dotted with petrochemical plants, which aren't so beautiful at all. At certain times of year, there are wildflowers blooming everywhere. And, of course, it's got the gorgeous live oak trees. So it's sort of dripping with atmosphere. But it's sort of the point of the article. It's funny that it even ran in the travel section, because although I wrote the piece as a travel story, it's really an environmental degradation story. As you well know, Jim, South Louisiana is in terrible danger of simply disappearing. Plaquemines in particular, and other regions south of New Orleans are in danger of disappearing because of the hubris of human beings. This is not a new story in Louisiana. I spoke at length with a faculty member at LSU who studies this stuff, and you've got an entire department at LSU who've been screaming and yelling for God knows how many decades about, if we don't do something, we're not going to have, like, half of South Louisiana is going to be, basically swallowed up by the Gulf of Mexico. And that, that is still the case. So what are you going to do about that? When you drive, as I did, down to Plaquemines, you got, I was on route, I don't have a map in front of me. I was on the main route down to Venice, the Venice Marina in Plaquemines, and it's just a little country road. It's not a real highway at all. And the whole time, the Mississippi River is above you, right? Yeah. It's above you on your left as you're heading south. Mm-hmm. And as the ships float by, it's like they're flying. It's a very weird thing. If you've never seen, of course, I'd seen that before, having lived in Louisiana for so many years. But it's bizarre, and it shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't be that way. If Mother Nature were allowed to take her course, the Mississippi River would not be going through New Orleans, let alone Plaquemines, at all, which, of course, would then devastate the entire economy of South Louisiana. And there you have it. It's a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. I don't have the answers.
Well, your story,
but I do have eyes that see.
Your story, Jennifer, was accompanied by a special section in the New York Times, The Drowning Coast, right. Climate Change is Pushing the Seas Ever Higher, Threatening Coastal Areas Across the Globe, but the epicenter may be Louisiana, where in the shadow of New Orleans, an existential question bears down on a little fishing village called Jean Lafitte. Which communities should be protected and which should be left to their fate? And in your story, you note that Plaquemines is an enchanted place, beloved by nature lovers and sportsmen, but given its fragility, how long will it remain a place at all? That is a legitimate question.
That's the question, and that's the question. I mean, that special section was great. I think the Times did that in conjunction with the Picayune and with I can't remember. I don't have it in front of me again. You do, but that was great, and it was long overdue. Very, very important question, and but anyone who's flown in and out of Baton Rouge as well as New Orleans, really, you look down, it's a different picture coming from Baton Rouge, but if you fly over New Orleans, either in any direction, you look down and you see water. This is not a secret, right? Mm-hmm. This is not new news. You look down and you see these little specks of land, and everywhere else is water. So after Katrina, the federal government, pumped in however many hundreds of millions, maybe billions of dollars to shore up the defenses, which, you know, is completely understood. If I lived in New Orleans, I certainly want my defenses shored up. You know, I would want to feel secure in my own home. How long that's going to last?
Don't know.
I sure don't have the answer to that. I don't think anyone does.
How do you reflect on the time you spent in Louisiana and here in Baton Rouge?
Well, you know, we raised our three children, pretty much. We raised them in Baton Rouge. When we moved to New Jersey, I don't know if I ever told you the story. When we moved to New Jersey, our eldest son, Sam, who's now in his late 20s, was just beginning his sophomore year of college. He went to college in Pennsylvania because he'd wanted to get as far away from home as possible. So he goes to college in Philadelphia, actually, which is not far. It's an hour and a half drive from where we now live in New Jersey. And Sam says to me, "Mom, you know, I hope you don't think you're going to be visiting me every weekend." I'm like, "Sam, I didn't even want to hang out with sophomore boys when I was a sophomore girl in college, right? You're crazy." But on the other hand, our twins, who are now 24, they started at the public high school in our town, very, very good school. But it's public high school. It's very rough and tumble, and it's big. They'd gone to private school in Baton Rouge. And my daughter was in this kind of rambunctious math class where the kids just wouldn't shut up, which just wouldn't happen, you know, in Baton Rouge. And she's not a great math student, so she needed to hear the teacher. And she stands up in front of the whole class and she says, "Y'all, please be quiet right away. I cannot hear Mr. Miller, and I need to learn this." And there was like this stunned silence. And the next day, every kid in that school knew there was this really pretty sweet girl with a southern accent who'd landed in their midst.
There you go.
Well, yeah. And they were just, it was like, you know, I was so proud of her.
Well, Jennifer, it is always a delight to talk with you. And once again, for those who'd like to read the piece in the New York Times, if you've not, "At the Mouth of the Mississippi, a Weird and Fragile Beauty," from the accomplished Jennifer Moses. And Jennifer, let's talk again soon. Thank you, dear.
Thanks.
This is Jim Inster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And we're joined by one of the special people in Hollywood and the world at large, Marion Ross. For 11 seasons, she was head of one of America's favorite television households. And now, in her memoir, she reveals much about life on Happy Days and beyond in My Days, Happy and Otherwise. Good morning, Marion.
Well, good morning. Good morning, Jim.
It's a pleasure to hear your voice, and I can hear your infectious enthusiasm as we talk a few thousand miles away. But you were known, of course, around the country, millions of Americans tuned in every week to see Mrs. C and the gang from Happy Days. And it's one of those things, it wasn't overnight stardom, it was overnight recognition. You worked a few years before Happy Days.
Well, I did. You know, I was under contract to Paramount when I was 23 years old, which now when I look back on it, now that I'm 89, can you believe it?
No.
So, that was quite I had a lot of drive in me.
Well, you still have a lot of drive at 89. And some would say, what took you so long to write about your life?
Oh, I didn't want to do it at all. I didn't want to do it. Not that I have any terrible bad things, but my son got a hold of this writer and he brought him out to my house and he said, "Now you talk to David. And he's going to write it all down." I said, "No." But then they kept coming to the house, and then we finally did it, yeah.
Hmm. Well, that cast had a lot of chemistry. I'm sure there was conflict as well, as you note. But what a remarkable group of characters you had.
Well, and you know, we're all still very close. In fact, today is Ron Howard's birthday, and then we're going to have a party. He's going to have a party sometime this month, and I go to lunch with the Fonz quite a bit.
And really,
Donnie and Donnie Most and Anson Williams. It's great. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we've talked with Anson Williams and Donnie Most recently, and they both seem to be doing very well in their respective endeavors. And of course, there was a tragedy with the loss of Aaron Moran.
Aaron, yes, that was very tragic. And so it's like I don't advise children of getting in the business unless you have very, very sensible parents. You know, it's not good.
Well, Ron Howard is one who got in the business early. He was world famous before Happy Days, being Opie on the Andy Griffith Show, but yet he kept it together. How did he do it?
Well, his father, Rance, and Rance just died about a month ago or so. He would take Ron. Rance stayed out of it. He would be up in the audience, you know, watching rehearsals all the time, but always stayed out of it. And then as soon as we were through with anything, he would take Ron home. You know, he did. Whereas little Aaron's parents jumped right in. They just had the best time, you know.
Right.
So Rance pulled him out all the time, you know.
Well, he's had a spectacular career and a guy who has truly been able to reinvent himself every step of the way.
Right, and now he's making another movie, and he's in Europe a lot filming, and his birthday's coming up. It's today.
Yeah.
Happy birthday, Ron. Yeah.
Well, you have rubbed shoulders with some of the greatest lights in show business, people like Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. How was that experience?
Yes. That was fabulous, because mostly that was about Noel Coward. You may not be as crazy about Noel Coward as the other people are, but we had the very first, we were doing Blythe Spirit at CBS, live, and that was in the mid-50s, you know, and we had the first read-through at Humphrey Bogart's house with Lauren Bacall, because Lauren Bacall was in it. So that was pretty darn exciting to me. So that's all in the book, you know.
Mm-hmm. How was Bogart?
He was not in this. He was reading, and he said he was so glad. He said, "I'm so glad I'm not reading today," because we were all reading the script. And I thought, look at that. And he was just playing with his children, you know.
Yeah, but as a man, was he the same kind of fellow he conveyed on the big screen?
Oh, yes. Oh, very much. Oh, very much so, yes.
Now, Marion, yeah. You're from originally from Minnesota and went to college at San Diego State. Was there a big break for you?
Yes, it was. I ran off and eloped when I was, I was just 21, and I was at San Diego State, and I did the leads in all the plays. And a woman at the college, who I didn't even know, but she had connections in Hollywood. So she said, "I'm taking you up to Hollywood on the train. Come on, we're going to 20th Century Fox." So she was, Rosa Kaplan was her name, a Spanish lady. She was very important in my life because she took me up to Hollywood to meet everybody.
Well, you have taken a while to write your memoir. As you note, you're proudly 89 years old, and this is
yes.
Something that will be in stores very soon. But the glamour that people associate with being a huge star, as you were and are, sometimes there's a lot of grit behind the glamour, isn't there?
Oh, there is. There is. You really want to. You've got to be well-grounded, and mine was from my childhood. My Canadian mother, you know, my father from South Dakota, I was a very well-grounded person. So while I was under contract at Paramount, I would watch, and I would think, don't do that, don't do that.
Yeah.
You know, you could see what you shouldn't do right in front of you, you know. And now, of course, women are so liberated and everything, but I was very, very well brought up. So if somebody made some kind of a pass at me, I would say, "You have no character," right in there. "You have no character."
I bet that shut them down.
It did. It stopped them in their tracks. So that makes me laugh now. I think, oh, my gosh, how did I ever survive this business?
Well, when Happy Days began in the early 70s, did you realize you had something special?
Oh, no. No, we didn't. No. It took like a couple of years. And then they came to us and they said, we want you all to sign a contract for 2 years, 2 years in a row. Okay. And so we began to get the idea that we were there to stay. But we had no idea we would last 11 seasons. And, you know, one of the reasons we lasted, mostly because of the Fonz took off. Henry Winkler, if you've ever met Henry, he's a wonderful, wonderful guy. But we also had a softball team, and every one of us was on the team. And we didn't want the team to end, you know? We cared about the show, but we certainly didn't want the softball team to end, you know? So that kept us going.
Gary Marshall, he died last year, or actually now about a year and a half ago. He was an amazing part of this.
Oh, amazing, amazing. And he would hire people. Like, we had a couple young writers that came to him, and their father had been a cab driver in New York City. And he said, my kids want to work in television. Gary said, send them out. Send them out to see me. And then he signed them up as writers, and finally they ended up creating a couple shows on their own.
Marion, in all your years in show business, was there anybody who intimidated you, who you thought, my God, there's a star beyond comprehension?
Yes. Actually, I say these things. Do you know who? I had a lot of trouble with Jack Lord on Hawaii 5-0. Isn't that something?
He was a suave guy, wasn't he?
Well, there must be other people that would have said the same thing about him. He just was not a nice guy at all. No.
Really?
Isn't that something?
He seemed to Steve McGarrett. He wasn't a nice guy?
Yes, right. No. So maybe I'll get letters. Maybe I'll get sued. But when people ask me, who do you, because everybody, I loved everybody else. You know, who else?
Except for Jack Lord.
We always like a little bad news, don't we?
Well, why was he a jerk?
Oh, he would just pick on me. He would pick on me.
Well, shame on him.
I know, shame on him. I do believe he's died now, so I can say whatever I want to, can't I?
Yeah. I think you just did.
I have to give you a little color.
Well, you're a fun person and have had a spectacular career. Marion Ross, and her memoir coming soon is My Days, Happy and Otherwise, and it is a pleasure and honor to speak with you, Marion. How's life in Los Angeles?
Oh, it's just wonderful, honey. I'm enjoying my life immensely, and I really am retired now, which is lovely. My daughter was a writer-producer on Friends. You remember the show Friends?
Oh, of course.
And now she's creating a new pilot. And my son is an actor. He's in that commercial where he plays George Washington. He's being tugged across the freeway.
Really?
On the rope, in that boat. Yeah, so that's my son, Jim. And so I have a very nice life here. I call my house Happy Days Farm, you know?
Appropriately. Well, thanks for sharing your story. You're quite a lady.
Thank you so much.
See
have
you
a
soon.
Lovely day.
Marion
Bye-bye.
Ross. Bye-bye. Marion Ross will turn 90 years old, by the way, on the 25th of October. So she's still around and still vibrant. And coming next, the vibrant John Wirt on the Academy Awards right here on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757 is your number. And John Wirt is in the house for 23 years. He was the entertainment writer for The Advocate. He still writes for The Advocate and other publications. In fact, he has a feature today, and we'll talk with him about that and the Academy Awards. 877-217-5757. Annie DeFranco coming to Baton Rouge at the Varsity tomorrow night.
Yes, Annie DeFranco. She pronounced it Annie. And she's lives in New Orleans since 2003.
Yeah, she's been on the show. And I think I did call her Annie, but thank you for correcting
That's
me.
Okay.
But she's had quite a career.
Oh, yes. When did you have her on the show? Because, you know, I missed that one.
It was a few years ago.
A few years ago, okay. Well, she's on tour now, on her Rise Up tour. And one of the shows is in Baton Rouge. She's played in Baton Rouge before. So she's still doing very well. She had real mainstream stardom, you know, in the mm-hmm. mid-1990s. But she has two children with producer Mike Napolitano in New Orleans, and they're raising the kids, and she tours, and she's currently writing her memoir. So yes, she's still in the midst of it all.
And diving headlong into politics.
She's been long, you know, politically mm-hmm. outspoken person, obviously a liberal and a progressive and all those kind of things. So, and that's showed up in her music and her following, too, her fans.
Ani DeFranco, tomorrow night at the Varsity Theater at the gates of LSU, 877-217-5757. Do you remember the Varsity as a movie theater? Were you still around then, or were you here by then?
I wasn't here when the Varsity was a movie theater, but I know that many college towns had their local art theater. In my hometown of Richmond, we had the Biograph Theater, which showed foreign films and film retrospectives and classics and that sort of thing, and that's what you had at the Varsity, from what I understand.
Yeah, it's a shame that it went away. It was two screens.
Exactly like the Biograph.
Yeah.
In Richmond.
Yeah, I remember standing in line one night with Jimmy Swaggart. He was going to see Fiddler on the Roof, and I was going to see Diner. Circa 1981.
That sounds about right.
But anyway, the Oscars are this Sunday, the 90th celebration of talent in Hollywood and beyond. And John Wirt, politics could certainly be a part of that.
Yes. Well, the Me Too movement will probably come up in some way or another. And, of course, Oprah Winfrey did her speech at the Golden Globes, which got a lot of attention. A lot of people talked about that. So we'll see if there's some moments like that, Me Too moments, Rise Up moments at the Oscars. We'll see.
Well, the nominees this year are an interesting collection, and you've talked about your favorite films of 2017 and at the end of the year, and many of those are on this list of the nominees for Best Film.
Yes, and The Shape of Water, directed by the Mexican director Guillermo del Toro, is still my favorite movie of the year, so my position on that hasn't changed. Really beautiful, romantic, sci-fi. It's a few different things, you know. And it's just a gorgeously made and rendered movie. It's too bad that, I don't know whether it's too bad or not, but the film has mm-hmm. been slapped with a plagiarism suit. So that may affect how people vote for it. We'll just have to see how that plagiarism suit wraps up.
The favorite is considered Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, which was also on your list.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I like that one very much. That's a great ensemble piece. And Frances McDormand is nominated for Best Actress, and it has a Best Original Screenplay nomination. So that has multiple nominations. Very worthy picture.
And The Post is nominated, a fantastic film that features Meryl Streep and WRKF's newest member, Tom Hanks.
Okay. Well, I don't, you know, as I admire The Post a lot, and I think it's, I know people, there are a lot of people who just hate anything that Steven Spielberg does.
Why is that?
It's some sort of reaction against perhaps his success.
Jealousy?
He can be maudlin in his films and very sentimental, and I'd have to ask him exactly. They probably say he makes lousy movies, but I don't think that's true.
I don't think that's true at all, and The Post is, he's at the top of his game.
I think it's a strong film, and I like it very much. I don't think it's going to do well at the Oscars this year.
Well, I'm looking, best actor in a leading role. I would have thought Tom Hanks would be nominated, as he has many times before, but he was not. The favorite is considered to be Gary Oldman for Darkest Hour.
And I completely agree with that, that he's my favorite, too. And it's one of those biopic performances where he totally transforms himself, and you never think that it's not Churchill. I mean, maybe someone who lived in Churchill's time and saw him in person would have another view, but from this distance of 70 years, this seems such a great performance and so totally convincing.
And the actress in a leading role, the favorite, is Frances McDormand, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. She's a veteran actress.
Oh, yeah, she's been around a long time. And it's great to see an actress who's been done so much work mm-hmm. in the past have another great role like this. It shows you how capable she is right. now.
And one of the actresses nominated for Best Actress in a Supporting Role is none other than Mary J. Blige. For Mudbound, she was performing at the River Center on Valentine's night. Did you go to that one, John Wirt?
I didn't make the show, but I got a little
interview.
You did
a review, though.
I wrote an advance, and then I wrote a Q&A with Mary J. Blige.
How was that?
Oh, it was fine. It took a while to get the Q&A back, so it didn't actually run
so
in the
paper.
So
you didn't actually talk with her this
No, was it, was a, Q&A email kind of thing, and that's you know, I'd rather talk to people as you would, I'm sure.
I don't think a Q&A would work
on
this show.
No, not at all.
But Mary J. Blige did do her A for your Q, right?
Yes, she did. It took a while, but it came back, and we got it online at The Advocate. So, and that's, I like her performance very much. It's so strong, and it's a great portrait of this woman in the just after World War II, who's this, the matriarch of a sharecropping family in Mississippi. But, you know, of course, this movie was filmed in Louisiana, Mudbound. And Mudbound is significant also because the director of photography is a woman, and she is the first woman nominated for Best Cinematography in Oscar history.
What about Best Director?
I would go with Guillermo del Toro,
He's
director of The Shape of Water. I think I'd like to see The Shape of Water, you know, win Best Picture, Best Director. And I have a feeling, though, that Three Billboards will win Best Original Screenplay. Although I would give that to Shape of Water, too.
Best Actor in a Supporting Role. I see the veteran Willem Dafoe is in. By the way, the last film I saw at the Varsity was The Last Temptation of Christ, which starred Willem Dafoe 29 years ago. He's nominated, but so is Woody Harrelson. Woody Harrelson is nominated, but the favorite is a guy who's in the same film as Woody Harrelson, Sam Rockwell, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
I completely agree with that. Sam Rockwell, it's one of those performances where the character takes a journey. He's an intolerant mess of a person near the beginning, and he goes on this journey where he mm-hmm. actually grows and becomes another person.
All right, so. And a gentleman, Sam, in Gonzalez says that Christopher Plummer should win for All the Money in the World. He was a late fill-in and replaced Kevin Spacey, didn't he?
Exactly right. That was a real accomplishment that they pulled that off. They wanted to replace Spacey after charges of sexual harassment.
They did replace him,
right? They did replace
him. Just took him off the screen like he never existed.
And they reshot entire scenes with Christopher Plummer playing J.
Like
Paul Getty.
30 years older than Christopher Kevin Spacey, but Christopher Plummer is an exceptional actor, and he pulled it off.
I love what he did in The Man Who Invented Christmas, which is another role he had in 2017. So, I mean, he stole the show, mm-hmm. The Man Who Invented Christmas.
What about The Host?
The Host, Ryan Seacrest?
Yeah, now there's some controversy about him.
You know, this keeps coming up. It's so prevalent. We're in this. I think some of the drama is diminishing a bit, but it keeps returning. We may have reached the crest on this wave.
I don't think so.
You know?
No, I don't.
It's just going to go more and more.
Yep.
Well, yeah. It certainly has been.
But it's going. You know, there's going to be a lot of political. Talk, but hopefully they'll get the right picture when they announce the winner of the best film of the year.
That would be amazing if they didn't.
Well,
how could that happen?
Maybe the Russians will mess it up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But last year, I thought Warren Beatty handled himself with about as much class as he could under the circumstances when he gave the wrong winner of Best Film.
And ultimately, it wasn't him. I mean,
it wasn't him, but he was out there.
Yeah.
And he did the best he could with what he had. But he's now 80 years old, John Wirt. And maybe we'll see Warren again. But it'll be quite an experience. And John Wirt says, Best Picture?
Shape of Water.
Okay. We'll hold you to that prediction. And that's it for today. Have a great weekend. We're back Monday, same time, same place. For Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Engster. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.